So today I'm going to talk mostly about Tony Blair, and not about Tony Blair as an individual, but about what he meant. So what? Because we do sometimes hear the word Blairism. Yeah, so another. That's two prime ministers got an ism in the 80s and 90s. And so in 1997, there is the victory of Tony Blair in the general election against John Major. And so that is to say, after 18 years of Conservative government, Margaret Thatcher elected in 1979, Tony Blair elected in 1997, 18 years of Conservative government, that's quite a lot. We're used to quicker moves than that, and certainly a somewhat different situation. As I mentioned, the trade unions not so strong at the end of Thatcher's rule as at the beginning, not only because of the laws of Margaret Thatcher, also very much because of unemployment, when unemployment is very high. Yeah, you know, when there is no unemployment and your boss says something you don't like, you shout at him. When there is mass unemployment and your boss says something you don't like, you say, "Yes, sir." I simplify a little bit. I'm sure some of you must know this. So let's look at Tony Blair. And of course, to understand Tony Blair, we have to look back at what happened to the Labour Party when they were in opposition. 18 years, the Labour Party wasn't the government, but the party continues. They controlled many local governments around the place, and they were preparing, trying to find the way to win another election. Well, in the 1980s, there was a big divide inside the Labour Party, probably a stronger divide than before. Tony Benn represented the left of the party, who really wanted to continue with the some of the things the Labour Party had done in the past, more nationalisation, an improved welfare state, so the traditional Labour values, more place for the trade unions. So that was the left of the party, also around a gentleman called Michael Foot, another leader of the left of the party. And in the 1980s then, on the right of the party, you had people like Neil Kinnock, who became the leader of the Labour Party. So what was the difference here? Well, it's the whole question. Look at 1979. Why did we lose? The left of the party said, we lost because we didn't do enough things for working people. We didn't make the millions of ordinary working people think, yes, the Labour Party is fighting for us. So what we need to do is we need to be more left-wing. We need to abolish nuclear weapons. We need to find more public spending. And we need to create jobs in the public sector, etc. Oh, no, said the right of the Labour Party. We lost in 1979 because the country has changed and the old ideas, trade unions, nationalisation, more and more welfare state, people are not interested in these today. Today we have people are much more interested in business, in the market. People are much more independent. People like, look at Margaret Thatcher. People like buying their council houses and owning their own houses. So what we need to do, says the right of the Labour Party, is we need to compromise and accept some of Margaret Thatcher's ideas. Object to others, but we need to abandon some of the old ideas. And in fact, this is a long process, but the biggest section, the biggest moments of it will be when there are two really, really important moments. The first one, and not necessarily in this order, but two symbolic moments in the 80s and the 90s. The first one is New Labour. That is that Tony Blair declared that we are changing the name of the party. When we go into elections, we're not going to be the Labour Party. We're going to be New Labour. Now, this is, words are extremely important in politics, and this is absolutely very, very radical change. Imagine tomorrow you switch on the television and you see the Pope in Rome say, "We have decided to change the name of the Catholic Church, and we're going to call it the New Catholic Church." Now, this would be extremely surprising, and I'm sure you understand why. When he says, "We're going to use the name New Labour," that means old Labour is bad. Old Labour is finished. Let's reject our history. And so it's a very, very important change, and this is why the Pope will not name the Catholic Church the New Catholic Church, yeah? Because you know, obviously they have a need for that tradition. So using the name New Labour is absolutely incredibly radical. What did it mean, New Labour? It meant trade unions, nationalisation, they're not so important. You know, the welfare state, that's not so important. And business is not so bad. We are not the party of the trade unions against business. And in fact, in one of the election campaigns, Tony Blair said, the Labour Party, New Labour, is the party of business. Now, he was probably exaggerating. A lot of business was not happy with Labour at all, any kind of Labour, new, old or indifferent. But nevertheless, the idea was very, very different. Yeah? And so all the older ideas and policies tended to disappear. And the second example here is the question of Clause 4. Now, Clause 4 became a symbol of this struggle between the left and the right of the Labour Party. Now, Clause 4 was it's a clause of the Labour Party constitution. And it was introduced in 1918. And it talked about the objective of the Labour Party. And this is, not the objective at all, not the objective, but the objective, yes. In fact, the objective of the Labour Party. It's quite difficult to talk and write at the same time. And here is Clause 4. Whoa, lost it. Of course, to secure for the workers, by hand or by brain, the full fruits of their labour, with the most equitable distribution thereof, which may be possible, based on common ownership of the means of production. It has a few more words, but that's the essential thing. So this is a clause which was introduced into the Labour Party constitution in 1918. And it became a symbol of, if you like, old Labour, the tradition of Labour. Now, there are two interesting things about this. First of all, it was introduced in 1918, but the Labour Party was founded in 1901 or in 1906, depending on the date you choose. Well, they didn't think of this in 1906. They thought of it in 1918. 1 year after the Russian Revolution. And this, I don't know how much you know about this kind of thing. This is a very clearly, this is a Marxist paragraph. Very, very clear. What do we want? We want workers to have the full fruits of their labour. Les travailleurs doivent recevoir tous les fruits de leur travail. What does that mean? It means that the present situation, capitalism, is where the bosses steal some of the fruits of their labour. Yeah, so this is a very clearly Marxist paragraph. It's nothing else. Yeah, it's a traditional Marxist paragraph. It was introduced in 1918 in many sections of the working class, Marxism was very, very popular. The Russian Revolution stopped the war. That's not bad for a beginning. And the image of the Russian Revolution in 1917 till 1921, 22 was very, very popular in the working class. So that's why they introduced it. Now, it was only a paragraph in the Constitution. This does not mean that the Labour Party in 1920, 1930, 1940, 1950 followed these ideas. They probably didn't very much. But symbolically, there was a Marxist objective in the Constitution. And so in the 1980s, the right of the Labour Party said, we must eliminate this, we must take away this paragraph. And that became the symbol of a conflict between two ideas of what the Labour Party should do. The left of the Labour Party said, the Labour Party is a party of the workers, it's a party of the trade unions, we are against employers. And the right of the worker, the Labour Party said, no, these are old-fashioned ideas. We cannot win elections with those ideas. And two, those ideas are not appropriate for the modern world. So a very, very long, very, very long internal conflict. And as you can imagine, Neil Kinnock and won. And this clause was eliminated. Clause 4 was eliminated. And replaced by something much more general about fairness and justice and things like that. So, important change there. So those are the two symbolic, rhetorical language changes. There are other changes as well, in particular in connection with the laws of Margaret Thatcher. Because, of course, when Margaret Thatcher introduced reforms, for every reform, many, many people said, okay, well, there's the reform. What do you think, Mr. Labour Party or Mrs. Labour Party? Yeah? And so the Labour Party always had to give their opinion about everything the government did. Of course, that's the normal way to do things. And the opinion changed. The manifesto changed. There was an election in 1983, in 1987, in 1992. And the Labour manifesto changed. At the beginning of this period, it was the laws introduced by Thatcher against the trade unions will be abolished. Then in the next manifesto, it was, will be adapted. And then in the final manifesto, I can't remember which one, 93 or 97, it said, the laws introduced about trade unions will not be changed. Yeah. So a very important symbolic change that the Labour Party was changing, was becoming New Labour, and one of the important elements were, we are not the party of trade unions. We're not against trade unions, but we are not the party of trade unions. So, and this also made many differences in their internal organisation, because in the organisation of the Labour Party, the trade unions had a lot of influence. For example, on the committee, the leading committee, there were certain representatives of the trade unions, etc. And the influence of trade unions in the Labour Party went down. So those are the differences. And now this, naturally enough, people saw this in different ways. Tony Blair said, we have modernised the Labour Party. Modernised. Okay, and of course, his critics said, you have betrayed the Labour Party. Okay, you pay your money and you take your choice. These are two different opinions, which you can choose one. Now, I'm now going to have to open the other file so that I can get my piece on Blair, Tony Blair. So, let's see, though. So, what did that mean when he got into power, and the or at least into office? And this is then the question of the Blair government's 1997 to 2007, I think, 10 years or so. And the title of this section is Continuity and Change from Thatcher to Blair. Now, of course, politics is very important to people, and so people often say things very simply. Yeah. So people who think that Blair did a good job will say, oh, Blair was completely different to Thatcher. And people who are very critical of Tony Blair will say, oh, it's the same. Thatcher and Blair, they did the same things. Now, both of these are exaggerations. Yeah. There are things which are the same. There are things which are different. So under this section, continuity and change from Thatcher to Blair, we have one, economy and privatisation. And I'm going to look at this in different sections. Welfare to workfare, trade unions, fairly briefly, education and health. What Tony Blair is most known for is probably his foreign policy. So I must admit, I'm doing a fairly political view of what's going on there. So there we have seven sections. That's probably enough. Economy and privatisation, from welfare to workfare, trade unions, education and health, foreign policy, constitutional change, and social and cultural changes. First of all, an overview. It's certainly clear that the project of Tony Blair was not the introduction of massive social reforms like the reforms of 1945. Also, his project was not the big social, the big, as you say in French, réforme sociétale, the big reforms of society of Harold Wilson in the 60s, the right to abortion, the legalization of homosexuality, the reduction of censorship, etc. And in fact, we shall see, pour vous vendre la mèche un petit peu, number six, constitutional change, will be at the center of Tony Blair's legacy. So, economy and privatization, well, it has to be said that in general, the... Well, I've lost my section on... there we go. Yes, so the aim of the economic policy of Tony Blair was probably summed up with the idea of reassuring the markets. As I was saying in the election campaign, Tony Blair was explicitly pro-business. He said, you know, the Labour Party is the party of business. This made the Labour Party rather exceptional within Europe. In many ways, the Socialist Party in France resembles the Labour Party today. However, I don't think a leader of the Socialist Party would say in an election campaign, Le Parti Socialiste, c'est le parti du milieu des affaires. I don't think they would say that. I think that would be politically complicated for them. So this made it a somewhat of an exception. But also, from a personal point of view, Tony Blair had a very different attitude. So, for example, Tony Blair would normally go on holiday with millionaires. That would be a normal thing to do. So he went on holiday with Rupert Murdoch, with Berlusconi, etc., which is something which Harold Wilson, absolutely impossible. Yeah, Harold Wilson was, I'm an ordinary man, look at my coat, isn't it horrible? So a completely different image. And so this is not an accident. He wanted to publicly say, you know, changing society is not about being against the rich. Yeah, my friends are Berlusconi, my friends are Rupert Murdoch. What's the problem? Yeah, New Labour is the best party, according to Tony Blair, because we have the best ideas, because we have the best experts, etc. We are not interested in conflict between workers and owners. This took a little time to establish itself in the Labour Party, because a lot of the ordinary members of the Labour Party did not go on holiday with millionaires, as you can imagine, because they were just ordinary people. So there's quite a lot of conflict, and certainly the Labour Party reorganised the party itself. The traditional party was very much based on local members doing the work. Traditionally in Britain, it's partly still the case, but certainly in the 60s and the 70s, at every election, if you live in Manchester, for example, every party will come and knock on your door. You open the door and say, hello, I'm from the Labour Party. I wanted to know, can we count on your votes? So, three possibilities. This is England, remember. Three possibilities. First of all, oh no, I'm sorry, we're Conservatives. Il s'excusait toujours. J'ai fait ça. So that's very English, isn't it? Yeah, it's very English, yeah. Number one, oh, I'm sorry, we're Conservatives. Number two, oh yes, we're definitely voting Labour. Or number three, oh, I'm not sure, let's discuss. Okay, so discussing, of course, the Labour Party member or the Conservative Party member is very happy to discuss. to try to persuade them. But the other thing which is very interesting is that if they say yes, we're voting Labour, okay. And on the day of the election, outside the polling station, there is one person from the Labour Party, one from the Conservative Party, and when the voters arrive, will you give us your number, your electoral number? Now, these are a Labour Party person and a Conservative Party person. The voter is not obliged to give their number. This is England. Everybody gives their number. This is not France. It wouldn't work in France, yeah? And so you have the numbers, and so at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so, number 345, they said they would vote later, Labour, and they haven't voted yet. So, we have a car here. Would you like us to take you to the polling station? C'est là où on commence pour y a une différence culturelle certaine. I can imagine in France, you know, you go, qui est là? It just wouldn't work. Yeah, it just wouldn't work. Anyway, so that was the old way of doing politics. And it's true that Tony Blair, with his New Labour, also changed that way of doing politics. And so much more important now was the television and gradually the internet. So, for example, let's imagine you want to become a member of the Labour Party. In 1970, you would go to a local meeting and discuss politics and say, oh, I think this, and say, oh, well, you seem to agree. Would you like to join the party? Yes, and you become a member. How do you join the Labour Party today? I want to join. Click. Yeah. Very, very few meetings, etc. So a change in the way of doing politics as well. Okay, so in general, let's say that on economic policy and privatisation, there was not a big difference between Margaret Thatcher, John Major and Tony Blair. Tony Blair wanted to build up London as a financial centre, and indeed the City of London is extremely important as a financial centre. Tony Blair believed that it was fine if the financial employees at the top, the top managers, received millions of pounds in salaries, that was okay, that's not a problem, because that encourages the economy. So this was the attitude. And it's true that privatizations continued. The privatization continued, and in fact, the actual privatization of the railways was finished under Tony Blair, not under Margaret Thatcher, but under Tony Blair. So the railways in Britain are private today. And as I mentioned last week, it's probably not a fair example, but it's a disaster. British railways are an international joke. As I say, that's a little bit unfair because some other privatisations were more successful, so I wouldn't want to be too... Much more integration of the private sector into the public sector. So, for example, today, under Blair, let's imagine you need a new hospital. The old method was that the public sector would build a new hospital, a public hospital. Under Blair, you have a new idea. No, let's find a private company. And the private company will build the hospital and then rent the hospital to the government or to the health service. Yeah. And so this made a lot of money for the private companies. Yeah. And this was also, you still got some of this same idea that private is better. Under Blair, you still got some of this same idea that private is better. Probably not quite so much. Much more idea of mixing the two together. Also, at the beginning, even today, I think the question of pensions under Blair and afterwards was a big difference, for example, between Britain and France. In general, old people in Britain are much poorer than old people in France. In fact, five years ago, they said 13% of retired people in France were living in poverty, and 30% in Britain. Yeah, so it's the generally situation of the pensions was much, much worse in France. However, something particular happened after 2001. After 2001, there was a very big change, and there was a big rise in public spending. Now, one of the things which happened was that unemployment fell a lot. For 5 or 6 years, unemployment was much lower than in the rest of Europe. Now, people don't agree. Some people say unemployment fell because of Tony Blair's policies. Yeah, and other people say, no, it wasn't because of Tony Blair's policies. These are things which are impossible to prove. But certainly, unemployment fell. And when unemployment falls, that means the government has more money. They don't need to pay unemployed people so much money. And also, people who are employed pay taxes. So the government has much more money when unemployment falls. And it's certainly true, after 2001, there was a lot more money for hospitals and for nursery schools in particular. You could see that, you could really see the difference, yeah, that there was a in 1998 or 1999, if my mother phoned a doctor, then the doctor would say, oh, I think I can see you next Friday. Yeah? And after 2001, it was, yeah, I can see you this afternoon. It was a very clear difference. And that's still the case today, that it's now very easy to see your doctor the same day. So certainly, yes, certainly there was much more money for education and health for a while. And let's say a little more about that. However, there was this move as I mentioned, from welfare to workfare. Now, I don't want to exaggerate this, but there was certainly a move away from universal benefits. What is a universal benefit? A universal benefit is everybody who has two children receives the family allowance, l'allocation familiale, the same amount. That's a universal benefit. If you're rich, you receive a family allowance. If you're poor, you receive a family allowance. It's the same. The new Labour under Blair tried very hard to change this method and give a thing like, for example, if you have two children, you receive £100 if you don't work and £200 if you have a job. Yeah? So trying to use the benefits policy in order to change the way people live. And certainly it made a difference. My brother has four children. It's very, very interesting because this one, when she was a baby, my brother had to pay £500 or more every month for nursery, for a creche. And for this one, it was all free. The government paid all of it. There was a big change. Yeah. I don't know what the... he's not having any more babies, so I can't tell you what's happening today. But yeah. So some changes. Also, a very interesting event. Well, I mean, not interesting if you're involved, but there you go. The Labour government organised a very big campaign against begging. Une campagne gouvernementale contre la mendicité. And in fact, they had big posters, enormous posters, do not give money to beggars. Yeah? This is politically interesting, if you like, that normally you would imagine, and certainly, for example, in France, in a few towns, there are campaigns like this, and it's always Conservatives or the National Front. Yeah, it's generally identified as a right-wing idea, but in this case, it was the Labour government, an enormous campaign against begging. In general, then, this idea of welfare to workfare is the idea that the government will help you if you find a job. So if you find a job which doesn't pay very much, the government will give you more money. But if you don't find a job, then the government will only give you the minimum. That's the idea. Now, of course, people don't agree. Some people say this is great. This encourages people to get a job, and this stops people from falling into dependency, etc. Yeah, that's one idea. The Blairist idea. And other people say, well, no. It's a very bad thing, because you are encouraging companies to pay very low wages. Because if the companies pay very low wages, the government will help the workers. So these are some of the changes which were made. Let's have a look at the relations with trade unions then. Now again, we're not surprised to come back to this question, because this was tremendously important for Harold Wilson, for James Callaghan, for Edward Heath, and for Margaret Thatcher, because trade unions are one of the elements which make it, from the point of view of the company directors, make it more difficult to make high profits. And from the point of view of people who defend trade unions, make people's working conditions more acceptable, and people have a better life. So there are an enormous, and even today, remember that, I think, I can't remember the figures now, they're just out, but even today there are 6 million trade unionists in Britain. It's still enormous, although much weaker after Thatcher. This is 6 million, much bigger than anything else going on. And so the relations with trade unions are a particularly important thing to look at. Now, I mentioned last week with Thatcher all these laws against trade unions. None of them were changed. Je crois qu'un sur vingt a été changé, mais on va dire aucun n'a été changé. So Blair kept the laws against trade unions. However, he did introduce a couple of changes. But first of all, I want to give you a couple of slogans. When Thatcher was talking about trade unions, at some point, she said, I can't remember when, she said, there will be no more beer and sandwiches at number 10. That is to say, I will not be like Harold Wilson, who is friends with the trade union leaders and says, oh, come to number 10 Downing Street, come to my house, let's have beer and sandwiches and discuss among friends. I'm the Prime Minister, you're the trade unions, we're all friends. And Margaret Thatcher said, no more beer and sandwiches at number 10. So it's a joli slogan, quelque part. And Tony Blair was fairness but no favours. That is to say, he said to the trade unionists, Tony Blair said, well, I will be fair, I will be just with trade unions, I'm not against trade unions, so you can have justice, but trade unions are just one group among many. They're not the most important to me. So this is new Labour, because, of course, the origin of Labour is we are the party of trade unions. Our objective is not to represent everybody in the country, but to represent the workers. And so this new Labour is fairness but no favours from the trade unions. So how did that show? Well, as I said, the reforms introduced by Thatcher about picketing, about ballots, about secret ballots, postal ballots, illegal strikes, etc., stayed the same. But he did introduce two important changes. And one was a law on trade union recognition. I put on my blog an article about the laws on trade unions just a few days ago. So you can go and have a look at that if you want. It's written by a brilliant writer, me. Okay, first of all, there was a new law on trade union recognition. What does that mean? Well, trade union recognition is when the company boss, the boss says, okay, I agree to discuss with the trade unions. And in France and in Britain, especially in France, in many circumstances, especially with the bigger companies, the company is obliged to discuss with the trade unions. They're not obliged to agree, but they're obliged to negotiate. And so the new law on trade union recognition in Britain said that if you have a company, let's say you have 500 workers in the company, if the boss refuses to talk to the trade unions, then you can have a referendum in the company, and if more than X percent, I can't remember, 40% I think, says we want a trade union to talk to the bosses, then the boss is obliged to negotiate with the trade unions. That is to say, so this is a law to help trade unions do their work. To say that the boss is not always, if the workers want a trade union, the boss cannot say, I refuse to talk to trade unions. That's it, it becomes illegal. This is an idea which is based on some laws which exist in the United States of America, in fact. The idea of a referendum for trade union recognition. So that's quite an important change. And the second very, very important change was the introduction for the very first time in Britain of a national minimum wage. And I think this was in 1997, directly immediately. So, national minimum wage, tremendously important reform, I think. Remember, in France there has been a minimum wage since 1968, so you can't remember what it's like. But in 1995, a few years before this, if you go to a hotel, a little hotel in Blackpool, and you talk to the woman who is cleaning, you say, how much are you paid? Sometimes it was, you know, like €1 an hour, €2 an hour. It was not, there was no minimum. It was not illegal. And as you know, there are a lot of poor people who really need work. And I'm sure that in France today, if it was legal to make people work for €2 an hour, you could find workers because people are desperate. Yeah. And so, for the first time, a national minimum wage in 1997. Now, this was received in different ways. Of course, many people thought, oh, well, this is good. Yeah, we don't want people working for €1 an hour, €2 an hour. So this is very good. And of course, there were also critics saying, well, a national minimum wage is good, but your national minimum wage is too low. Yeah, so there's still a political conflict about it, but certainly it did eliminate some, for example, oui, les serveurs qui n'ont pas de salaire mais qui ont que les pourboires, par exemple. That was very common, and now it's illegal. So yeah, there is something that had changed. So those are the important changes about trade unions. Let's have a look at, where was that, to health and education, was that right? Yes?
How high is it today?
Oh, yeah, good question. I don't know, I'm afraid. It's also a little difficult to calculate because the exchange rate between the pound and the euro changes, yeah? But I can say it's lower than in France. That's definitely lower than in France. Quite a lot lower than in France, yeah? In France, it's quoi, c'est 10 euros, no? I think in Britain it's 6.5 or something. It is lower than in France, that's for sure. There's another problem we have in work in Britain today, and this is the 0 hour contract, where you work 3 days on Monday, and then the boss says, "Oh, we don't need you anymore. I'll phone you when I need you to work." Yeah. You don't have any guaranteed work. But I'll phone you, and then phone you on Thursday morning. Come in now, I have 8 hours work for you. But you have no guarantee. This is what's called a 0 hours contract, which is discussed today. There's an election in a few weeks in Britain, as you know, and one of the questions of 0 hours contracts is one of the big points of discussion. Okay, so let's have a look. I'm not going to go back to my tableau de matière, just in case I'm not following it. Let's have a look at education under Blair. And again, I think it's fair to say that in general, the general trend of education under Blair was to continue the kind of concepts which inspired Margaret Thatcher's policies on education. Remember I told you last week, but I'm going to repeat it, that private education in Britain is very small, 7%, Small, not very important. However, the public sector has found different ways of integrating the public and private sector. Let me give you an example. Under Blair, they had a new system where they measured the exam results of every school. And if you had a school which had very bad results, what they did was they closed the school, they found a private company to organise the school. The private company employed teachers and they had 5 years to get good results. So this again is like Margaret Thatcher was doing, that is that it's a private company running the school, but it's not a private school. The students coming do not pay, nobody pays. Yeah? It's government money, and the government gives money to a private company to run the school. That was one thing. And the other thing was much more in the ordinary schools, in the state schools, much more independence for the headmaster. So, for example, under Blair, you got the new system, which is, you know, I'm the headmaster of the school. We have a lot of problems with mathematics. I want a very good mathematics teacher. You're a mathematics teacher. I will pay you 30% more than the other teachers, because we need a mathematics teacher. That is to say, this is something which would be normal in a private company, and this is now instituted in the public sector. In particular, then, less power for local government. More independence for individual schools, less power for local government. Tremendous encouragement for specialist schools. What is a specialist school? It's simply a school which concentrates on one subject. So, it doesn't mean that, for example, you can have a specialist business school. That means that the students, a college, the students do the same subjects as everybody else, but 5 hours a week, every student does business, because we're a specialist business school. Or you could be a specialist music school, or a specialist sports school. And there are most schools in Britain now are specialist. Now, like I say, this is probably a question of 5 or 6 or maybe 7 hours a week. The rest of the time is the normal subjects. Yeah. So specialisation, and of course the school can choose its pupils. It's not the school is not obliged to take everybody who lives near. They can choose. Everybody is. I want to go to this specialist music school or this one. Now, the people who defend this idea, this is the idea: more choice for parents. So the idea of Tony Blair and his defenders is, in this way, parents have more choice, and schools are in competition with each other. Yeah. If nobody wants to go to this school, we close the school, and we replace it with another one, probably in the same buildings. Yeah? So this is encouraging competition within schools and choice for parents. And of course, people who criticise it say, well, in reality, it doesn't give choice for parents. It just gives choice to the most active and informed of parents. Yeah. For example, the people, parents who have money. So, right, yeah, I know which school we want to go to. Okay, so let's move house and live near the school that we want, and so on. Yeah, that, you know, I mean, if you have 5 schools and one of them is the best school and it has 300 places, then you can't give more choice to all parents. You can only give choice to the people who succeed. It's increasing competition. That's the criticism made. The final one, which is probably a little surprising in a way, is that Tony Blair encouraged the development of faith schools. That is to say, religious schools. And by the end of Tony Blair's time in governments, there was a very large number of religious schools. Now, when you imagine a large number of religious schools, you say, that must be, very varied. There are many religions. In reality, 4,600 Church of England schools, 2,000 Roman Catholic schools, 37 Jewish schools, 9 Muslim schools, 2 Sikh schools, and 1 Hindu school. Yeah. So in reality, it's really a rise of Christian schools. It's not a rise of, they say faith schools, but in fact it's a rise of Christian schools. Higher education was an even bigger element because under Margaret Thatcher, I went to university when Margaret Thatcher was in government. I went to Cambridge University and I had to pay £0, exactly zero, from the beginning to the end. I received money from the government to help me live. I'm not trying to make you jealous. You have an advantage. I'm old. Okay? But it was completely free. The university was completely free, including Cambridge University or any other university, completely zero. Under Tony Blair, he introduced tuition fees. Alors, on traduit des fois frais d'inscription, mais il faudrait traduire frais de formation. Parce que l'idée, c'est pas simplement payer l'inscription, mais payer les frais. From zero, it went to £1,000. Immediately, from zero to £1,000. And today, as you know, it is £9,000. When Tony Blair finished, it was... Tony Blair was the first to introduce tuition fees, £1,000. And then a few years later, £3,000. And today, under Cameron, then £9,000. Now, this is obviously a big change. I'm sure I can't find many people here who would like to pay £9,000 for your year at university. Yeah? No. Now, this is a very big philosophical change because the welfare state idea was the country needs university graduates. And so the country will provide university free for perhaps not for everybody, but for the people who we think will be successful in it. But the attitude which governments have today is that if you go to university, you then have a higher salary than somebody who doesn't go to university. So it is an individual investment. This is the idea of, well, certainly Margaret Thatcher, but also Tony Blair. It's not my idea, right? It's his idea. University education is an individual investment in an individual future. And this is very different from the traditional welfare state idea, where that university education is perhaps a right, or at least a national need which needs to be dealt with collectively. I want to go on to the big two changes, constitutional changes and foreign policy. Je change peut-être de... Allez, je vais les faire les deux quand même. Very briefly, I would like you to read up a little bit on Tony Blair because I'm going very quickly. Foreign policy, the most important thing is the war in Iraq. And Tony Blair was an enthusiastic participant in the war in Iraq, even though the war in Iraq was tremendously unpopular in Britain. And in fact gave rise in February 2003 to the biggest ever anti-war demonstration in Britain. You know that in Paris, every few years, you have a demonstration of 1 million people. It's surprising, but it's not very surprising. In London, it's absolutely, it never happens except once in 2003. It's a very, very interesting element. Let's say that, I'm not going to give details of the foreign policy, I don't have time, but let's say that Tony Blair decided that the best thing for Britain was to be the closest ally possible of the United States of America. And so he followed very closely, much more closely than France, Italy, and the others, the priorities of George Bush. It's interesting to see that Tony Blair almost lost his job on this question. There was a vote in Parliament. It was very, very close. So that's interesting because certainly Tony Blair was prepared to lose his job. His idea of the future of Britain was the closest ally possible of the United States. And if I lose my job, that's okay. Now, I don't want to be too generous to him. If he lost his job, he would immediately get a job for, you know, a very, very, very well paid job which he has, in fact, he's representative, peace representative in the Middle East or something. Yeah, so I don't want to be too generous to him, but certainly he was prepared to lose his job as Prime Minister for this. And the second element, more important, I think, constitutional changes. Now, as you know, the British Constitution, which is not written down, changes very, very slowly. Yeah, let's wait 250 years, then we'll change something. And the biggest changes for centuries were under Tony Blair. So what did he do? Well, first of all, following his promises, he organised referendums. I say he, of course, it means his currents, his friends and all that, you know, quite a big group. He organised a referendum in Scotland and in Wales and in Northern Ireland to allow them to establish autonomous parliaments. So there is now a Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh, the Welsh Parliament is Cardiff, and the Northern Irish Assembly in Belfast. And these autonomous parliaments, so of course they are not independent, you understand the difference, yeah? Autonomy is not independence, because for example, important questions of finance, defence, etc. are all decided in London. However, the autonomous parliaments in Scotland and in Wales have a lot of power. They organise health, education, transport, tourism. It's a lot of power. So that's an enormous change. The biggest change since Scotland had a parliament before 1707. Yeah, and then they had to wait till 1997. So an enormous change there. Which, of course, the result was a little later, the independence referendum last year, where they decided not to become independent in Scotland. Second enormous change, the House of Lords. Now, I'm almost very surprised that this went unnoticed in France, but when you see the name of the House of Lords, you know, it's the second house, it has a similar role to the Senate, revising laws, checking laws, etc. And when you see today you see House of Lords, you think, oh, well, it's the aristocracy. Lords, it must be the aristocracy. Today, in the House of Lords, there are almost no aristocrats. And Tony Blair eliminated them. What did he do? Before Tony Blair's reform, there were two different kinds of people in the House of Lords. There were the hereditary lords. I am a lord because my father was a lord, because his grandfather was a lord. You know, the aristocracy. And there were what we call the life peers. I am a lord because the Prime Minister asked the Queen to make me a lord. My son will not be a lord. It's not hereditary. A life peer. And so that is to say, in any case, Tony Blair eliminated the hereditary lords. He didn't shoot them. He simply meant that they were no longer allowed to vote in the House of Lords, except for a very small number. So from the aristocracy was a majority in the House of Lords in 1996 and a small minority in 1997. Now, of course, this is a very important democratic reform, because although the members of the House of Lords are not elected, they are chosen by a Prime Minister who was elected. So it's much more democratic than you are a Lord because your father was a Lord. So the abolition of hereditary peers. Now, if you remember that the previous reform of the House of Lords was 1958, and the one before that was 1911. Everything happens very, very slowly. But Tony Blair did even more than this, and he established a Supreme Court. That is to say, he abolished the existing system, which was that the House of Lords was the top court in the land. You appeal, and you end in the House of Lords. And he established then a Supreme Court in Britain. So, autonomous parliaments in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, the abolition of hereditary courts, a new Supreme Court, enormous constitutional changes which had not been done for, I don't know when the last time was, but you know, hundreds of years. And finally, on the level of constitutional changes, the passing of a Freedom of Information Act. an American idea, but a very interesting idea. It's a very simple idea. Before the Freedom of Information Act, you are a journalist, and you think that this hospital is racist, that their management is racist, and you would like to see the documents of their management meetings. So you write to the hospital, please show me the documents. And the hospital says, no. After the Freedom of Information Act, if you demand any documents, the hospital or any government, any public sector, they are obliged to say yes, or to give a very good reason why they cannot, which is, you know, like national security or something like that. So this often happens, you know. So the journalist writes to the Freedom of Information person, say, I want the compte rendu, the minutes of the management meetings of this hospital. And okay, and you receive them, and then you look at and you think, look at, yeah. So many secrets come out. That's just one example. There are very many important examples. For example, one journalist discovered that the British government had given a lot of help to Israel to develop nuclear weapons. It was a complete secret, and the Freedom of Information Act idea. So just a last element then of Tony Blair's priorities. So if he's marked it in some ways, he's probably remembered for two things. In fact, he is remembered for the war in Iraq, which was very unpopular and is today very unpopular. And one of the reasons is that the document which he used said, you know, this is a document about Saddam Hussein, this is why we need to go to war. And it was discovered that the information was all false. So he has quite a bad reputation today because of the war in Iraq is a big question. But perhaps in 100 years' time, if he's lucky, people will remember more the constitutional changes, the final abolition of the aristocracy inside the governmental system. Of course, this is bad news for the Queen, because 20 years ago, there were two institutions in Britain which went from father to son to son to son, the hereditary principle, the Queen and the House of Lords. Now, there is only one, the Queen. And so, it's kind of, I'm feeling very lonely. The country has recognised that it is not fair and it is not modern to have hereditary representatives in the House of Lords. Oh dear. And you can see the Queen is working very hard for her popularity. You saw at the Olympic Games, she met James Bond and pretended to parachute into the Olympic Stadium. She's working very hard so that people won't notice that it's not really very 21st century to be Queen. Thank you for listening. I will see you in 2 weeks' time. And I will be